The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha. Thank you for your patience. To continue with our discussion of ceaseless practice, the sixth ancestor, Huineng, who many of us, most of us probably know about, he was a woodcutter in the district of Xinning, probably poorly pronounced. He could hardly have been called an intellectual. While just an infant, he lost his father, and he grew up under the care of his aged mother. He worked as a woodcutter in order to support her. While standing at a crossroads one day, he overheard one line of a scripture being recited, and immediately parted from his mother in order to seek the great Dharma. He was a great vessel for the truth, of a caliber rarely met with in any generation. His pursuit of the way was unique among human beings. To cut off one's arm is easy enough, but to sever himself from someone he loved must have been exceedingly difficult indeed. He would not have abandoned his filial obligations lightly. There are various accounts of Huineng's life, and this is the only one where I've seen any mention of how hard it must have been to part with his old mother, his only relative. Apparently a benefactor gave him some money for her support, which would help to ease his mind, but still, it can't have been easy, especially in China, with the emphasis on filial piety. So it was kind of nice that Dogen mentions this. And in a number of these stories, he just mentions the human side of the person's training, how hard it must have been, how cold it must have been, somebody out in the snow in the mountains, how difficult it must have been for Bodhidharma crossing to a strange land and so forth. To cut off one's arm is easy enough. Well, doesn't sound too easy at all, but it's a one-time thing is what he's pointing out. And then, of course, you have to live with the consequences of having only one arm. If indeed Tase Weka did cut off his arm, this is Bodhidharma's disciple that Dogen's referring to, purportedly, reputedly, legendarily, cut off his arm to present to Bodhidharma as a sign of his sincerity. And there's different ways of understanding it. It may not have been a literal cutting off of his arm. Reverend Master Hubert says in a footnote that it might mean that Tase Weka used the sword of wisdom to cut off his dualistic thinking. And Reverend Master Koten wondered if it might be that his arm had been cut off previously as punishment for something, and he'd carried it around with him. Who knows? There's different ways of understanding it, but it might not be a literal cutting off of his arm. Anyway, Dogen talks about Tase Weka later on. But in this context, it's the continuous effort, the steady faith and dedication of Huineng. He's relinquishing attachment to his mum, which is not just a one-time thing. It comes up again. The dedication, no matter what the obstacles might be that he's talking about, it's not the great gesture, the one-time thing, impressive though that might be. It's the constant, steady, modest training. Reverend Master Jiyu often used to say, it's easy to make a grand gesture. It's not so easy to keep up the continuous daily effort that doesn't look like much, but that actually gets us there. It's this continuous, humble, daily effort that Dogen is pointing to. So Huineng goes to Diamond Konin's monastery and is set to pounding rice, which he does night and day. This is a very humble job, but he does it wholeheartedly and works hard without complaint for 8 months. And then he receives the transmission from Diamond Konin, who tells him to flee for his own safety. Most of us know the story of this, so I won't go into it here. It's a wonderful story. But Dogen says Hui Neng still carries his stone mortar with him and continues to pound rice. Well, I'm sure Dogen doesn't mean this literally. Hui Neng surely did not lug a great stone mortar around with him. He had to flee at night in a little boat, and he lived with hunters for many years. I can't imagine him taking his rice pounding device. So I think this means he continued his daily practice, unpretentious yet giving nourishment. Rice often means the Dharma. Eating rice means absorbing the Dharma and doing one's training. So I think this means that he kept up his practice unseen and unknown for a good number of years, just quietly pounding his rice, doing his training, until it was time for him to come forth and tell people who he was. Now Dogen goes on with numerous examples of the ceaseless practice of our ancestors, all of them different. There's a long section about Bodhidharma and all the difficulties he faced, and his immense faith and courage, his ceaseless practice. And then there's more mention of his disciple Taiso Eka and his ceaseless practice. And Dogen's own master, Tendon Nyojo, and his exemplary training. He talks about all of these and many more. And this chapter's full of invaluable advice about training. And as I said, we're just going to talk about a few of these people, otherwise we'd be here the whole week and we want to do different things too. Well, it occurred to me that all of these examples of ceaseless practice, except for the Hui Neng, who was a layperson until he became ordained later, but nearly all the examples are about monks. However, in Dogen's Zui Monkey, which is not part of the Shopagenso, it's some of his informal talks to his own monks, he gives many examples of lay people doing magnificent training, ministers of state who lead really busy lives and still manage to do their meditation and study the Dharma, people who do the honest and honorable thing at some considerable cost to themselves, this kind of thing, lots of them. So he just didn't put them in the Shobogenzo. So don't think ceaseless practice is just about monks, and this certainly was not Dogen's view. So I just thought I'd mention that because it occurred to me that this ceaseless practice is for all of us. In over and over, he talks about the training of lay people and what wonderful examples they can be for monks. So, Hyakujo. Let's find him. Hyakujo is a well-known master. From the time when he was serving as an attendant monk to Basso until the evening when he entered Nirvana, he died, there was not a single day that he did not endeavor to work for the benefit of the monastic assembly and for the benefit of other people. Meditation Master Hyakujo was already an old monk of long standing when, thank goodness, he said, a day when I do not work is a day when I do not eat. This is a very famous saying. He still endeavored to do communal work just the same as those in their prime. The community felt sorry for him because he was old. But though they expressed their pity for him, the master would not quit. Finally, one day when he came to the communal work, the monks had hidden his tools and would not return them to him. So the master did not take any food that day. And the disciples felt abashed and gave them back. His intention was to express his regret at not being able to participate in the monk's communal work. This story has become known as Hyakujo's one day without work is one day without food. And Hyakujo wrote manuals, rules for training in temples, which the rules themselves were eventually lost. We don't have them, but many other monastic rules come from Hyakujo's old rules. So he was a really remarkable person. Well, this one day without work is one day without food. It sounds great, but what happens if we can't work? What if we're sick or infirm? Clearly, we still need to eat. Our real work is our training. It's our ceaseless practice. For Hyakujo, it was doing physical work with the community. For others, it might take a different form. The point is to continue our ceaseless practice, whatever situation we may find ourselves in, not to worry if we can't do all the physical things, to do the training of the heart, to keep turning to the three treasures, to do our best to sit still in the midst of all conditions and accept them. That's the real work. So we don't have to worry. For Hyakujo, it was this other way. People are different, different forms of training. But it's a very helpful example of ceaseless practice. Now we have Joshu. Joshu is another well-known monk of the ancestors. The Reverend Monk Joshu was in his 61st year before he gave rise to the intention to realize the truth, and therefore began to seek the way. Carrying his bottle gourd filled with water and his monk's traveling staff, he set out in search of a master. He traveled far and wide in all directions, constantly saying to himself, "Even a child of 7 has spiritually surpassed me. I shall explore the matter with him or her accordingly. I'll learn from them. Even an old man of 100 has not yet spiritually reached where I am. I shall instruct him accordingly." It was with this attitude of mind that he did his utmost for 20 years to study Nansen's way. Nansen became his master. Being willing to learn from a small child, we have a scroll depicting Joshu as an old monk asking the way of a young child. The attitude of humility, willingness to learn from anybody, is an example for us. In China, especially in those days, old age was revered. So for an old person to ask for instruction from a child would be a most unusual thing. Willingness to accept teaching from whoever, wherever it may come. Meditation master Gosson, he talks about his, hang on a minute, where are we? Yes, meditation master Gosso talks about his master's master. When he first took up residence on Mount Yogi, the rafters of the old buildings were in ruins and the damage from wind and rain was extensive. It was midwinter at the time. The temple halls throughout the monastery had long been damaged. The monk's hall was especially dilapidated. The snow kept drifting in, and it so filled the floors that there was nowhere for the monks to sit. Veteran monks, their hair white with age, were sweeping the snow off everything, including themselves, and shaggy eyebrowed monks of venerable years looked as though those brows were knitted with apprehension. The monks of the community were unable to do their seated meditation tranquilly. When one patch road monk asked in all sincerity whether repairs might be made, the old master turned down the request, saying, "Our Buddha has said that this period of time corresponds to the general eon, and even high cliffs and deep valleys shift and change, never remaining constant. So how can we possibly seek to sate ourselves by fulfilling our every wish? The saintly ones of olden times, for the most part, did their walking meditation on bare ground beneath the trees. This was the ancient and exemplary way of practice, a profound custom that went far beyond simply the form of walking. You have all left home life behind in order to pursue the way, but you have still not learned how to use your hands and feet harmoniously. A monk's life lasts barely some 40 or 50 years. Who has time to waste in vain pursuits, such as making ostentatious buildings?" So the upshot was, he did not go along with the request. He wouldn't do it. This is Gosho's grandfather, as it were, in the Dharma. So next day, in giving teaching in the Dharma hall, Kosta told his monks, when Yogi, his grandfather in the Dharma, when he first came here to reside here as abbot, the roofs and walls of the buildings had fallen into such neglect that the floors were completely covered with drifts of snow. We hunched up our necks and grumbled in the gloom. But then, with a change of heart, we recalled the old ones who had resided under trees. So there's lots of stories like this. The old monks refused to worry about comfort and would fix the buildings. Joshua was the same way. Well, nowadays we don't do this. We live in a lot more comfort than these old monks. We couldn't do it even if we wanted to. We'd be in trouble. But when we train wholeheartedly and look at ourselves honestly, we have plenty of discomfort and we can find peace of heart, the change of heart. With a change of heart, we realize the old one. We recall the old ones who had resided under trees. At first, the monks are all grumbling about the cold. And then, with a change of heart, they remember these old ones. We can grumble about our lives and our problems, our discomforts. Or we can have a change of heart. We can accept them and be grateful for what we have, whether comfortable or uncomfortable, and see it helping us. We can't force a change of heart. We can't make ourselves be grateful. But we can cultivate gratitude. We can allow our heart to change. And I think this is really important, this change of heart from grumbling and complaining and blaming external conditions or blaming the old abbot who wouldn't fix anything to thinking, well, look what the old ones did, you know. They weren't comfortable. They trained wholeheartedly. We can do the same. And the same master, Venerable Master Gosar, once said, practice is not something that lies beyond thoughts and feelings. And thoughts and feelings are not things that lie beyond practice. And Dogen really emphasizes this. He says, give great weight to these words. Ponder upon them day and night. Put them in practice from dawn to dusk. Do not allow yourself to be vainly blown about in all directions by the gusting winds. Well, what does this mean? Practice is not something that lies beyond thoughts and feelings. And thoughts and feelings are not things that lie beyond practice. Dealing with our thoughts and feelings is part of our practice. It's not something separate. One does not lie beyond the other. Dealing with our resistance to what we don't like or find what we find difficult. And sometimes we might think, well, I'll just get myself comfortable, get my life together, find a quieter place to live, and then I'll be able to train better. Well, at first those old monks couldn't meditate in tranquility, but then they had a change of heart and found that they could. It's the change of heart. Yes, you might want to fix up the buildings, but it's the heart that needs to change. So even though Gosso never fixed up the buildings, still many people came to train with him, and they put up with the conditions and didn't complain about them. They thought, okay, this is what we got, we'll live with it. And of course these gusting winds that blow us around are not just our outward conditions. Our various states of mind, our thoughts and our feelings, the things that come up in our meditation, or in our daily life, these are all gusting winds. So as Dogen says, don't allow yourself to be vainly blown about in all directions by these gusting winds. Sit still in the midst of them, do the best you can, and accept what comes your way. Not always easy. Sometimes we can fix things, sometimes we can't. Sometimes we just have to sit in the snow and make the best of it. Further on in this chapter, Dogen says, you should do your utmost to thoroughly explore through your training the arising of body, speech, and mind, along with your inner experiences and the outer conditions that affect you. From the start, the meritorious activity of the Buddhas and ancestors has great benefit in spiritually helping ordinary people as well as those in lofty positions. Even so, such people do not recognize that the ceaseless practice of Buddhas and ancestors is helping to rescue them from their suffering. The ceaseless practice of the Buddhas and ancestors has helped us and helped innumerable beings, whether they knew it or not, from the lofty to the lowly. It's helped us to be here today. It continues throughout space and time. And our own ceaseless practice helps countless beings too, now and in the future. We must not doubt this. We are ceaseless practice. It's part of our body, mind, and heart. The ceaseless practice pervades us through and through. Never doubt it. Dogen goes on. Do not get into discussions about great hermits and small hermits. Do not talk about someone being sharp-witted or thick-headed. Don't make judgments about people. Don't make judgments about ourselves. Don't puff ourselves up as being really smart, or put ourselves down as being thick-headed, or compare ourselves with other people in any way, whether I'm better than them, I'm worse than them, or even I'm the same as them, as the Buddha said. To make such comparisons, to puff oneself up or put oneself down, isn't the point. These things don't matter at all when it comes to training. Just trust our simple, unpretentious, daily, ceaseless practice without worrying about who's sharp-witted, who's dull-witted, the great hermits and the small hermits. Simply discard fame and gain forever, and do not get all tied up in worldly things. Dogen often talks about the dangers of fame and gain. He came from an aristocratic family and with a lot of political power, and he deliberately kept away as a monk from powerful and wealthy people. He had some wealthy supporters, but he was really careful not to get pulled into fame and gain, not to depend on anybody, but just to depend on the Dharma. So he talks about fame and gain quite a bit. He sees the dangers of these things. And there's also the fame and gain of cultivating the self, being respected, successful, and so on. Or seeing ourselves as respectable, successful, competent, wise, or whatever we might think of ourselves or want to think of ourselves, both for good and for ill, to think of ourselves as being competent, wise, clever, or dim-witted, stupid, I can't really do it. None of this is helpful. Just do the ceaseless practice without worrying about, am I doing better than other people? Am I doing worse? Am I a terrible trainee? I think I'm doing quite well. All of this stuff, quite useless. Dogen goes on, do not let time slip away. Put out the fire that is burning atop your head. Don't waste time. Dogen talks a lot about this in this chapter and in others. Don't waste time, it's precious. Don't wait for some great enlightenment experience, thinking that this is what it's all about. For the great enlightenment, he says, is synonymous with our everyday tea and meals. This is wonderful. The great enlightenment is synonymous with our everyday tea and meals. It's not some great enlightenment experience. Just doing our everyday training as human beings. Nothing special. Not standing out. Not looking for some great experience. Just doing our honest best. And conversely, he says, do not aspire to non-enlightenment. As we're saying, thinking I don't have what it takes, my training is terrible, probably never get any better. Otherwise the Dharma remains concealed, he says, and we don't make use of it. We need to make the best we can of what we have. Do the best we can with what we have, not to put ourselves down, not to puff ourselves up, not to wait for some great enlightenment experience that's going to solve all my problems and now then I'll be fine. The great enlightenment is our everyday practice, our everyday tea and meals. We realize it, we make it real for ourselves, put it into practice. We're not waiting for something we don't have. We already have it, we just need to practice it. It says, separate yourself from attachment to things. My home and my homeland. My bonds of affection. My reputation. My wealth. My family. There's a common theme here. My, me. They're not a permanent refuge or a source of perfect happiness. My homeland, my reputation, my family. They can be a joy. And they can be an impediment if we let them, if we let ourselves invest our happiness in things, people. And it's let, and he says also, we need to let go of my not having such things as fame and gain and so on. I don't have any of these things. I am unattached. I don't have these problems. It's not about I have or I do not have anything. It's about letting go of me and my stuff. Whether I have stuff, I don't have stuff. It's the me. Just doing the ceaseless practice in whatever situation we're in. As he says, this is nothing other than the matter of ceaseless practice. Your letting go of fame and gain throughout your whole lifetime will be your ceaselessly putting into practice the one matter, for it is this ceaseless practice that is as endless as the life of Buddha. Once you have established the ceaseless practice here and now, your ceaseless practice will be done by the ceaseless practice itself. The practice does the practice. And you should love and respect your body and mind, which are imbued with this ceaseless practice. It's by this very body and mind that we can train ourselves. We should love and respect them, treat them with care, but not be a slave to them. They're ours on loan, as it were, a temporary body and mind. Do our best with them, take care of them, use them for training, but don't hold on to them. Like all of these things, there's nothing wrong with any of them. Only if we invest everything in any of these things, to completely invest in our body. What happens when we get old and weak? To completely invest in our brain. What happens when we start to lose our marbles or we just, you know, something happens to us? All of these things, wealth, success, even our family, we love them. And yet, they can be a source of grief as well as a source of joy. It's the clinging on. This will make me happy. This person is a source of my happiness. It's a huge responsibility to be responsible for someone else's happiness. We can't be. We have to make ourselves happy, to train ourselves, do our ceaseless practice. And then we can live with all these things. Vimalakirti never renounced the world. He was always a lay person. But he was able to live with that. We can do that. You all do that. Living with our situation, whether we're monks or lay people, doing our ceaseless practice with the things of our lives, but not investing all our happiness in things that pass, taking constant refuge in the three treasures, the thing that actually is our true refuge, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Not making our true refuge. Anybody, anything, any situation, body or mind, because all of it eventually passes away. And with that, interestingly, we can love people more because we're not squeezing them for something that they can't really give us. We can give to others and we can receive. And there's a generosity of giving and receiving. because we're not squeezing something by trying to get something. Now, Dogen talks at length about the value of time. Don't waste it, he says. Were you to live 100 years but fail to see what the nature of all Buddhas is, it was still not equal living even one day, having rightly grasped the matter, the great matter for which we train. This is not something that one or two Buddhas have said. It is what all Buddhas are continually putting into words and putting into practice. Within the recurring cycles of birth and death over hundreds and thousands of myriad eons, one day in which there is ceaseless practice is a bright pearl within the topknot of the king. It is the ancient mirror within which we are born and die, and it is a day we should rejoice in. The strength of our ceaseless practice is a joy in itself, the joy of ceaseless practice. Thus, he says, a single day must be of great importance. Your life of this one day is a life you should cherish, the skeleton, the body, I guess, you should prize. Thus, if your life were to last but a single day, if on that day you grasped what the nature of all the Buddhas is, then that life of one day would have surpassed many lifetimes spanning vast eons. So if you have not yet grasped the matter, do not squander one day idly. This one day of ceaseless practice is a precious jewel that you should prize. Sages of old prized it even more than their whole life. This is why the saints of old and the former sages prized their days and months. They prized time more than they prized their own eyes, and prized it more than their native land. To idly let time pass by means to be polluted and corrupted by the transient world of fame and gain. To not let time pass by idly means to act for the sake of the path whilst being on the path. And he talks at considerable length about this. This is something you should constantly reflect on. You should consider it even as you sit by a window, looking out on some slowly blossoming spring day. And do not forget it, even as you sit in a humble abode on some desolate rainy night. How does time rob us of our efforts? Not only does it rob us of one day, it robs us of the merits of many eons. What animosity is there between time and us? Sad to say, it will be our own lack of practice that robs us so. This is due to our not being on friendly terms with ourselves, to our thinking ill of ourselves. This is interesting. Not being on friendly terms with ourselves, thinking ill of ourselves, not thinking we're worth the life of Buddha, that we can practice the life of Buddha. Not trusting that the life of Buddha constantly flows through us, and ceaseless practice flows through us. Our ceaseless practice flows through all beings. The beings we love, the beings we know, the beings we don't know, past, present and future, flows through all of them. Even Buddhas and ancestors have not been without their various involvements, but they've let them go. Even Buddhas and ancestors have not been without their loved ones, but they have let them go. Even though we prize our relationships, such connections between ourselves and others are not things that can be held on to. So if we do not let go of our loved ones, chances are that our loved ones will let go of us, both in word and in deed. If you can have compassion for your loved ones, have compassion for them. To have compassion for our loved ones means letting go of them. And for monks, this means leaving home life behind. And for lay trainees, it's relinquishing that grip, not squeezing the life out of our relationships, but letting our relationships be as they are, working on them, nourishing them, but not grabbing, not wanting something, wanting happiness or wanting too much. Of course you want happiness, but not trying to get something, but just giving ourselves, but without clinging too much. Not easy, not easy. This long chapter, great Master Dogen ends in this following way. Calmly consider, a lifetime is not all that long. Even when the sayings of the Buddhas and ancestors consisted of merely three words or even just two words, what they gave expression to would have expressed what all the Buddhas and ancestors truly are. And why so? Because the bodies and minds of Buddhas and ancestors are one and the same. So their one or two phrases all express the genial body and heart of a Buddha and ancestor. The genial heart, the kindly, joyful heart of a Buddha and ancestor. This body and heart of theirs also comes to us, and it expresses our body and heart. At the very moment when they express it, their expression comes to us and expresses our own body and heart. And this life of ours also expresses the embodiment of past lives. As a result, when we awaken and become a Buddha, and when we become an ancestor by having a Dharma heir, we go beyond Buddha and we go beyond ancestor. The ability of two or three words to embody our ceaseless practice is in no way different. Do not vainly chase after the sounds and forms of fame and gain. When you do not chase after them, then this is the very ceaseless practice that the Buddhas and ancestors transmit directly, one to one. Whether you seclude yourself within the world or seclude yourself apart from the world, whether you are wholly enlightened or half enlightened, what I recommend is that you cast aside the myriad things of the world and your myriad entanglements with them. For this is the ceaseless practice that Buddhas and ancestors practice ceaselessly. Never doubt the value of our ceaseless practice, in whatever situation we may find ourselves. In faith and humility, without expectation, without conditions, I could train so much better if things were different. To accept our situations as they are, there's nothing wrong with them, fundamentally. Sometimes something needs to be changed, we need to do something, fine. But the real change is that change of heart to accept our conditions, accept our lives, our relationships, our joys and sorrows, and not cling to them. Our ceaseless practice, we're not forced to do it, no one can force us, we can't force ourselves to do it. We just follow the heart that seeks the way. It's a practice of love, love for the Dharma, love for the three treasures, faith in the three treasures, the heart that seeks the way. We'll talk about this tomorrow. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.